that you could always speak your mind. You work so hard to say what's right.
Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is April 10th, 2019, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is, What Do All the People Know About Confirming Endotracheal Tube Placement? And our guest skeptic is Dr. Scott Weingart. Scott is an ED intensivist from New York City and runs the very popular EM Crit blog and podcast. Scott is attempting to bring upstairs care downstairs, one podcast at a time. Welcome to the SGM, Scott.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I've been wanting to be on for a long, long time.
Oh, and I have been trying to get you. I remember one time we were sitting on a couch. I think it was in New York City. And I'm looking deeply into those eyes of yours, and I'm like, you've got to be a guest skeptic.
I've been waiting for my chance, and now I've finally been called up, and I hope I could fulfill my duties.
Well, we've known each other for a few years, and one of my favorite pictures is us at Smack together and me holding up this big Yeti mic, and I've got a goatee, you've got your classic goatee, and I'm trying to channel my best Scott Weingart with my hair slicked back and giving those really pensive-looking eyes that stare right at you. One of my favorite pictures from Smack.
It's a good one.
All right, well, this is an SGM Extra, and it came out of a episode number 249. This was an episode with Chip Lang looking at using POCUS, that's point of care ultrasound, for endotracheal tube placement confirmation. It sparked a bit of Twitter conversation. Can you briefly tell the SGMers what piqued your interest in this particular SGM episode?
Yeah, so I had seen your tweet, and then after the set of tweets, I actually went back and listened to the full episode. I hadn't heard this one yet. And there was a statement made that in cardiac arrest, only about 2/3 of the endotracheal tubes will be accurately identified by waveform and tidal CO2. And that, to me, was a potentially dangerous and misleading message.
Yeah, and so what was your particular tweet that you put out?
Yeah, and this tweet was deliberately provocative, but it was made because I think, if people are not incorporating the idea behind it, then they are maybe doing a disservice to their patients, and I wanted to piss people off. So it served both purposes, and the tweet was, as far as I know, and in the face of all the evidence I have seen, with compressions, and I'm adding here, and a blood volume to circulate, because I didn't put it in the original one, but I think it is the real, this is what we honed it down to, and I think it's really key. There will always be a waveform with a properly placed endotracheal tube. And after 6 to 8 breaths, there will never be a waveform with an esophageal endotracheal tube. And I know you always will be a failure if you use the word always, and you should never use the word never. Black Swan would be the book to read to understand why, but I think the statement was, it served its intended purpose.
And I don't want to gloss over what you just said, because you mentioned Black Swan, and that's on my additional resources on the SGM website, one of the really best books I've read about that whole concept about black swans. But you also put always and never in all caps. Oh yes, you were yelling at the Twitterverse, always and never. So I think you feel fairly strongly about this.
I do, and I think it's key to understand that I said as far as I know and in face of evidence I have seen. So that does change your always and never, because if tomorrow I saw a perfectly placed endotracheal tube with no waveform and functional equipment, then I would not be able to make that statement anymore. But that being said, I will support this statement. I will continue to maintain, despite its hyperbole, that this is really key, and I believe it holds true. And that's, I guess, what we'll discuss today.
Yeah, exactly. And there was a few things that you had reached out to me and you said you wanted to say a couple of issues. One was the blow to no, and one was no trace, wrong place. Can you explain those concepts briefly?
Yeah. So if you wanted the more legitimate version of my statement, it would be these two nicely rhyming or easy to remember phrases. And the blow to no means that a lot of the reasons waveform and tidal CO2 doesn't give you an accurate answer is equipment malfunction. It's not drawing in air or gas. It's not set up properly. And you'll never know if you just de novo take that piece of equipment and put it on an endotracheal tube you've just placed on a cardiac arrest patient, or the EMS brings in a patient and you stick on the end tidal CO2. is the tube in the right place or is it an equipment malfunction? I would get in the habit of every time you use this device, blow on it yourself and see the waveform pop up before you stick it on the patient. And then you know if there's no waveform, it's because the tube's not in the right place. And that's the second statement here, which if there's no trace, you're in the wrong place. Now, the reason to just remember this as opposed to the converse is that what we could say, I think beyond any shadow of a doubt, is that if there is a waveform of the proper shape, you know, not some little perturbation on a line that you would have to use a microscope to say whether it's actually a flat line or not, but instead you see a waveform after each breath, then that is a endotracheal tube in its proper place. Now, if there is no trace, yes, that endotracheal tube still can be in the trachea, but pulling it is going to lead to a situation which, while not all ideal, will push you towards patient safety. Now, I will support the converse as well. I know you want to get in there, Ken. But I think if you just remember these two things, you'd be in very good shape.
I just want to let everybody know that I threw Scott's game off when he was talking about microscope because I threw on my old man glasses. Because after flipping over the big 5-0, I've noted that I need these things to see some small little things. But maybe we'll have to put that in there. A microscope or some cheater glasses, if you need those.
There you go.
All right. And you had some questions that you wanted to ask me. But before we get into those questions, I think we should, in any discussion, come down to what we agree with first. Like, what do we agree about? And so I wanted to start with a few statements that I hope we can agree upon and then move on to some of the questions that you posed to me. Is that all right?
Yeah, I'd love that.
So the first one was that we, and I'm saying we because Chip Lang was the person who did this podcast with me, we believe that waveform capnography should be used to confirm tube placement.
Well, are you saying in cardiac arrest or in general patients?
Yeah, this is in any patient.
Well, that's incontrovertible, that outside of cardiac arrest, no one disagrees that end-tidal CO2 is probably perfectly accurate in both directions.
Excellent. And let's move on. In our SGEM bottom line, we were conservative. I don't like to overreach. And we said that POCUS has the potential to be used. So we didn't say it should be used or must be used. We said it has the potential to be used, but in conjunction with other methods like waveform capnography.
I have no problem with POCUS. I am an avid ultrasound user, and there are a couple of different methods out there to use POCUS to confirm endotracheal tube placement, and having those in your quiver, great. So that was not the problem. The problem I had was when the statement was made that in only 2/3 of the cases will it correctly identify endotracheal tubes.
Oh, don't get ahead of me here. Okay, let's just talk about what we're agreeing with here.
Sorry.
So, and then the next thing we had in our case resolution, we stated that while you directly visualize the passage of endotracheal tube through the vocal cords, which I think is a good thing, she, the operator, the person intubating, the clinician, is able to see the appropriate findings consistent with successful placement. And this is waveform capnography is used in addition and further supports the appropriate placement of the tube.
Yeah, even if I see directly on a fiber optic or video laryngoscope the tube passed through the cords, I still put the end-tidal CO2 on there.
Exactly. And then finally, our clinical application was that point-of-care ultrasound, which you've claimed to be a fan, represents another potential tool that can be used in combination with existing methods to verify correct tube placements. And then we went and said, you know, these bedside devices, you know, they're going to become smaller and more affordable. So it'll be interesting to see how clinicians use them in their practice. You're okay with that?
I am. And we'll discuss why I think this shouldn't be your primary method a little bit later in the show based on what you told me. Is that right, Ken?
Yeah. And certainly we're not advocating for it to be your primary method. This is just a potential use. So it's not the use. We certainly wouldn't want people to be taking something that's potential and superseding what we're currently already doing as our first method or all the different methods that we're using. So, all right, now, it was interesting. You sent me this email with 7 questions, and I'm like, oh, how am I going to do this? I can't do 7. I can't counter that on one hand. I'm going to have to take off, you know, like a glove on the other side. I 5, okay? So I modified it down to 5, even though that was a bit artificial. So we're going to go through 5 questions, and please feel free to go ahead and pose question number 1 to me.
All right. So who has the burden of proof when we're talking about knowledge?
It depends, of course. And from a philosophical point of view, we're not going to be talking about a legal burden of proof. But from a philosophical or scientific point of view, the person making the positive claim, and the claim is supposed to be positive claim, has the burden of proof. And this is known as onus probandi in Latin. And so if you've got two individuals like ourselves, which are discussing an issue, the person who makes the claim is responsible to justify that claim by providing evidence to support their position. And the evidence can then be reviewed after presented and decided upon whether or not it's adequate to meet the burden.
Yeah, I would agree with most of that. Where I disagree is the concept of positive, because positive is semantics. We could phrase any argument as I'm making the positive argument or the negative argument. The earth rotates around the sun rotates around the earth. Either one could be phrased in a positive way. So I've always thought about the burden of proof as the person making the new argument. And I think there is support for that concept. And that's how I've always determined onus probandi. That's the definition, is if you want to make a new claim, then the burden of proof is on you.
And I guess we are getting to semantics, and I don't mind that distinction. And it could have just been the person making the new claim. I am absolutely okay with that. All right. So in our recent SGEM episode, we made a general claim in the background material. The claim was that there is evidence. So evidence exists indicating that commonly used endpoints for rapid confirmation can be inaccurate.
Yeah. Well, there's the problem. Because the evidence was from well over 15 years ago, I think if I remember correctly, 19 years ago or 18 years ago, and had been superseded by a number of statements by groups that I think set what is good care. For instance, in this case, who deals with cardiac arrest? Well, it's going to be in America, the American Heart Association, in Europe, the Emergency Cardiac Council, or I might be misstating that, but both of these groups have put out guidelines stating that in cardiac arrest, end-tidal CO2 is the confirmation method to be used.
So this wasn't a specific claim. This was a general claim. The claim is that there is evidence indicating that commonly used endpoints for confirmation can be inaccurate. And this was actually after providing the ASEP policy statement talking about physical exam, direct visualization, which you already said you don't rely on solely. You still throw on the end-tidal CO2 monitor. You must have some sense that it could be inaccurate. Pulse oximetry, chest x-ray, esophageal detector devices, and then, of course, end-tidal CO2 detection. So that was just a general statement saying that there's evidence. Whether or not it's old or new doesn't make it right or wrong. That would be an argument from antiquity. So just because evidence is old doesn't discount it. New evidence, like you said, has to supersede it. So that there is some evidence is a true claim, that there is evidence that some commonly used endpoints can be inaccurate.
Well, let's be clear here. All of the clinical methods have been distinctly shown to be inaccurate.
Then you would agree that that statement?
So I absolutely agree with your statement about the common. It's the specific claim that I actually have issue with.
Right. And that's what I wanted to get at. And so here's where it comes down to the crux. It was that we made a specific claim about end-tidal CO2. And the actual claim in the blog post, and this was in the background material. This was just to set up the, hey, here's what we're going to be talking about today. And we made a specific claim saying quantitative waveform capnography, thought to be one of the best methods, correctly confirms tube placement only 2/3 of the time in cardiac arrest. And we provided evidence for the claim of 2 observational trials and 1 randomized control trial.
Yeah, and so this is really the crux of the discussion here. And I'm going to approach it from a couple different vantage points, and you tell me if I'm making sense, Ken. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
So first of all, you have 3 references there, all by the same group of authors. They did basically the same protocol 3 times. And of interest, one of the keys from all 3 of these trials is that if you saw a clear waveform, the tube was in with 100% accuracy. And I'm using very distinctly not the word sensitivity and specificity, because it becomes very confusing. Because again, what's the positive and what's the negative? Are you searching for an esophageal place tube as the condition or a tracheal place tube? And it becomes very confusing. So I'll try to actually keep it with the things they're actually finding rather than using the terms we'd commonly use in evidence-based medicine. So that's it. And that's the no trace, wrong place paradigm being proven.
I'll just pause you there with the 100%. I agree that those three studies did show 100%, but we always have to recognize that these studies were small and they have limitations. And the limitation would be there is a 95% confidence interval around that 100%. So there is a probability that it's not 100%, with the lower confidence interval being somewhere in the mid to upper 90s.
Yes, and I agree with all of that. And no matter how perfect your studies are, there's still always the possibility. But every piece of subsequent literature, and there's not been a single shred that shows a beautiful end-tidal CO2 waveform and a tube in the esophagus, except for surgical malformations in which there's a connection between those two structures. So, and that's, again, the supporting of the no trace, wrong place paradigm. And if you pulled a tube that happened to be in the trachea because there was no waveform for whatever reason, which is what these studies would purport, then all that happens that's bad for that poor patient is they get a second intubation attempt or placement of an LMA. Now, in just a few minutes, I'll explain why even that's not true, but we'll get there. So you had these three trials, and in some of them, there were properly placed tubes in the trachea that they did not see a waveform. And it was a very consistent number. It's the two-thirds you mentioned in all three of these trials. Now, looking at this, it completely lacks face validity. And I will explain why, and I'll also show you the proof of why it actually lacks evidentiary validity as well. But I read these three trials again in anticipation of talking to you. You're too smart not to put in the legwork. Now, if what I'm saying is true, and I'm in no way at this point saying it is, could you, being the smart clinician you are, figure out a reason why, when I say it's 100% accurate, they would find only 65, 66%. Could there be something clinical going on that's different between what I do and what they do?
Well, absolutely there could be something different. And remember, these are three studies done in Japan, three small studies done in Japan, and studies where they don't intubate in the EMS setting. These individuals had out-of-hospital cardiac arrest by and large and presented in cardiac arrest to the emergency department at some significant time frame after their arrest.
Yeah, and that's what they said in their trial and their limitations, and that's what groups that looked at these trials subsequently said. I don't buy that, because I've had patients hour and 40 minutes into arrest, and they still generate end-tidal CO2. So that in my mind can't be it. My supposition, and I'm fairly certain it's true, because I think they would have discussed it in their methodology if it wasn't true, is that they were not doing CPR during some, if not all, of these endotracheal tube placements. And in that case, then there would have a perfectly valid reason not to detect waveform end-tidal. And based on their writing of the methodology, I think they were hands-off chest. This was in the early 2000s, where the continuous compression idea was not there, where people were routinely, I mean, unfortunately, even now, people are routinely stopping compressions to perform endotracheal intubation. And back then, it was even more prevalent. And I think that is the discrepancy. And you will note this yourself. If you stop doing compressions, very often the waveform will disappear. And that is my belief on why these three studies that are all essentially the same study from the methodology standpoint did not find 100% presence of waveform with a properly placed endotracheal tube.
I think that's a really good rationalization and explanation for why they found the results they found and why they differ from the results that you've experienced. I guess the burden would be on you to demonstrate that other than rationalize it.
Absolutely. And we will do that right now. So now, if that alone was the case, you know, these three trials happened, and yet we have now almost 20 years of clinical experience that directly invalidates what they are saying, then you might have to say there was something different between now and those studies. And if I didn't have a shred of additional evidence, I would still find the face validity of that's lacking. Now, luckily, there is evidence. It's the evidence that led in 2010 for the AHA to make the statement that this is an accurate method during cardiac arrest. There were subsequently two studies, one by Silvestri and one who I'm blanking on the author's name, but it'll be in the show notes, in intensive care medicine. And these weren't primarily cardiac arrest studies, but they had a significant portion of their patients suffering cardiac arrest, and they did break out their results by that condition. And in both of these trials, the sensitivity and specificity were 100%.
So the Silvestri study that you referred to was in Annals in 2004, and it was the effectiveness of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest on continuous end-tidal carbon dioxide monitoring. And this was a prospective observational study of 153 patients. And while you said, I can't remember exactly the term you used, but it was only one-third that were in cardiac arrest.
About 53 patients, yeah.
So you have a handful of patients. Unrecognized missed tube placement was 9%, and they found a nice round number in the patients that had continuous end-tidal CO2. And that nice round number was zero. So zero tube unrecognized. The problem with this study, though, is it was a single-center study, and it was an observational study, and some of the departments didn't have end-tidal CO2, and they didn't control for different patient or paramedic factors, like how much experience the paramedics had. They didn't confirm whether they actually used the end-tidal CO2 monitor. It was all self-reported. So, you know, while I agree that we have additional evidence, this is weak evidence at best.
Well, and let me just take issue with one thing you said, because I think this often sets our residents down the wrong path. This is not a treatment trial, Ken. We're not looking for randomized controlled data. In fact, diagnostic studies that RCTs are so rare as to be almost a unicorn. And that's not even the burden of proof on a diagnostic study. In fact, observational trials are the standard for diagnostic studies. You need a gold standard, and then you need your test diagnosis the new form of diagnosis, and then they're just compared against each other. You're not looking for RCTs. I mean, RCTs are great in diagnostic studies, but that's not what we look for on our pyramid of evidence.
So an RCT would be stronger, but just because you're doing an observational study doesn't mean you have to do it poorly. And if they don't control because they didn't measure patient factors and they didn't control and measure paramedic factors, how can you say that there aren't confounders? And you can't honestly say there aren't confounders because you didn't even look for confounders.
Oh, I didn't say that. I simply said you said this is not an RCT.
No, exactly. No, and that's why I'm saying it was supporting my weak evidence. And the weak evidence wasn't just the fact that it's an observational study, but actually within the observational study, they didn't have very robust methodology to try to control confounders.
I'm fine with that, but let me be clear here. Diagnostic new test methods are not proven with RCTs. RCTs may show patient benefit from diagnostic test methods. For instance, the Swan study that was so seminal to get rid of the PA catheters. But that is not how we evaluate diagnostic studies. That is not low-quality evidence because it's not an RCT. These trials comparing a new test to a gold standard are the highest form of evidence for establishing the accuracy as opposed to the patient benefit of a diagnostic test.
So I will defer to Chris Carpenter, and I'll reach out to him after we've recorded this to confirm that.
Yeah, I'm super curious to hear what he said.
Because we're getting out to the periphery with regards to that. Again, my sort of comment was that it's limited because it's observational. It doesn't say it's not the highest form. It just says there are limitations associated with observational studies. And in fact, this observational study was weak because they didn't control, and they actually specifically mentioned that in their limitations, that they didn't control for all of these patient and paramedic factors.
Yeah, again, I'm not disputing any of that.
All right.
Now, the intensive care medicine study, on the other hand, I think is a stronger study, certainly more patients and methodology better. And again, 100 and 100. Now, look, again, Black Swan, I'm sure it would not be the most surprising thing in the world if someone found a failure of a perfectly placed endotracheal tube to generate a waveform, even with the various provisos I put in my statement. But the opposite would be astoundingly surprising to me.
Yeah, and I would acquiesce that the data from the three sites or the three citations we provided were limited and weak. So I will acquiesce that. And I don't think that the number is as low as two-thirds. I'm happy to acquiesce to that as well. But, you know, it's not a hill I'm going to die on, because the whole purpose of the show wasn't to talk about end-tidal CO2 confirmation. Because, again, we agreed right off the bat, both of us, all of us, are going to use this device and should be using this device if it's available. And if it's not available, we should advocate that it should be available. So, you know, I feel strongly about that. This was just a tee up for saying, hey, how does ultrasound look?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess the next question I had for you, Ken, is when does the standard of care, a term I despise, translate into the established evidence, and therefore anyone going against it would have the burden of proof? At what point does that transition occur?
Yeah, it's, you know, you're asking a question that, of course, I'll give my EBM mentors answer. It all depends. I mean, certainly I have problems with the standard of care as well, because it has legal definitions as well. But standard of care just means what most people are doing. And what most people are doing doesn't speak to whether or not the claim is true. And I want to know whether I'm doing a truly good thing or not. And I like to use the example of bloodletting for Camp Fever, and that was SGEM number 200. And this takes us back 200 years ago to Alexander Hamilton, who was a medical student at the time when he did this study. And he rose up and challenged the standard of care, which was bloodletting. And so it must have taken some pretty strong individual to say, listen, everybody's bloodletting, everybody's rationalizing why, oh, if somebody died, they clearly didn't bloodlet enough, they didn't do it early enough, they didn't take it off in the right order, they should have done the right arm instead of the left arm because they're right-handed, you know, all these post hoc rationalizations. He took this on and randomized people into the standard of care, which was bloodletting for soldiers with camp fever, and I'm suspecting they had sepsis, but camp fever, and then they compared it to not bloodletting. And the results, those in the standard of care group, 29% died, and those who were not bloodlet, only 3% died. And so that gave you a number needed to harm, which was death, of 4, because they had an absolute risk reduction of 26.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I'll just go to one statement you made, which is that the standard of care is what most people are doing. That's standard care. That, you know, you could define that very differently. Standard of care is the accepted ideas about good practice by a group, which is slightly different. You know, it might just be semantics, but, you know, that's why I hate the term, is it does become a legal definition. But it is what, if you continued down the path, it would be difficult to say negative things about your care. That is the one thing it offers.
Well, we've seen lots of things that are standard of care, and bloodletting was the standard of care. It wasn't just the standard care, it was the standard of care. People would argue vigorously that that's what you should be doing. So that was the standard of care. And my point is that just because it's the standard of care doesn't speak to whether or not the claim is true. It's an argument from popularity, so it's a logical fallacy. I want to know whether the claim is true or not.
No, absolutely. Though it's not an argument from popularity. It's the scientific method. It is a Bayesian approach to new knowledge. And so to challenge bloodletting took an amazing heterodoxic mind. And, you know, thankfully it happened. But you need a lot of evidence to move from what is an accepted viewpoint in the world of science.
I agree, but we're not trying to move away from using waveform capnography. I don't think we are we?
You're not.
No.
And no, I'm saying, I'm agreeing with you, you're not. But there was a statement made and on Twitter and on a podcast that it's only accurate in 2/3. Well, that also is a very strong heterodoxic statement. It was made in an offhand manner, but I think it has potential danger for someone who may be at the nascent stages of their career to hear, oh my gosh, maybe I shouldn't be using this at all. That's my claim.
It's danger, Will Robinson. Danger, Will Robinson.
Exactly.
And it's good that we're doing this to really highlight an important point. And, you know, the claim that was made was that there is evidence. Now, you can dispute the evidence and you can say the evidence isn't valid and you can say that the evidence isn't sufficient to meet the burden of proof. But you can't dismiss the claim that there is evidence.
I'll dispute the word evidence. Because there is literature, right? But the two are very different. And I guess this gets into the last questions that we'll talk about, which is what it actually takes to interpret literature. But before that, let's talk about the ultrasound a little bit. And I make the contention, and I'm curious to hear what you think, that there's sometimes a difference between real-world application of evidence and the theoretical conclusions made in studies. And this, I think this POCUS for endotracheal tube conformation is a perfect example of that. But what comes to mind when I say that there may be a difference between real-world application and theoretical study applications?
I absolutely agree with you. And even though we're going through these five questions after the fact about the things that we agree on, I think we're going to agree on a lot of these things as well. And of course, there can be a difference between real-world application and theoretical study applications. And this is one of the bases of evidence-based medicine. I mean, we have the literature, evidence or literature, but we have the literature that informs our care, but it shouldn't dictate our care. I mean, we still need to use our brain. We still need to use our clinical judgment, and it takes place in a context. And we also have to ask the patients what they value as part of that whole real-world application. I mean, it reminds me of that Jurassic Park quote, "Just because we can, nobody asked if we should."
Oh, yes.
Create dinosaurs. And so, yeah, there's a real-world application. Yes, we can theoretically do this, but should we do this? And those are two different questions. So I 100% agree there's a difference between real-world application of the literature and the theoretical studies.
Yeah, the reason I say it, and you know, we'll go to another ultrasound technique that's been nicely studied in the theory world and just doesn't, in my mind, relate to actual practice, which is ultrasound to find the cricothyroid membrane for emergency surgical airways. Yes, it's a perfectly valid technique. They studied it now, I think, in two or three trials. It probably is accurate in those trials. I think the internal validity of those studies was fine. And this is a ridiculous technique. In the real world, in the actual situation in which the authors are advocating it be used, it would fail horribly. I've seen it fail horribly. I've had, you know, people relate clinical cases of grabbing an ultrasound machine as a patient's becoming critically hypoxemic to attempt to find the membrane because they don't want to make the big cut. And so this is exactly what I allude to. And that was my worry with advocating POCUS for endotracheal tube conformation is in a study setting, this might work wonderfully, and I just don't know. It very well might translate to high adrenaline situations as well, but they haven't shown it does.
And again, that's why, you know, we were very conservative in our bottom line by saying this has potential. We were not advocating for using. We were not saying thou shalt use this. We were not saying this would be a standard care or standard of care. We were saying this has potential, interesting, but if you're going to use it, it better be used in conjunction with the existing techniques, and in particular, waveform capnography.
Yep. Yeah, you were very clean, as you usually are, about making statements that hold up. So, yeah, absolutely right. So then the fourth question.
Oh, no. You're not getting to the fourth question, because we've got to have a Princess Bride quote. I mean, if the two of us are meeting, this is for Amo Matu. I mean, you put in something in your brief little email to me. When life is on the line, how can you be doing this? And it brought back, you know, Vincini saying, you've fallen for one of the two classic blunders, the first being never get involved in a land war in Asia, but only slightly lesser known, never go in against a Sicilian when death is on the line.
Perfect.
This goes along with the real world application and the theoretical application. I mean, if you're saying when death is on the line or when life is on the line, it could be considered a logical fallacy and appeal to emotion. But I understand where this was coming from. I mean, the critical nature of the situation doesn't provide evidence of whether or not the claim is true. But I do recognize it'll influence clinical decisions, the severity of what you're doing. And that decision is independent of whether or not there is evidence to support the claim.
Oh, I wasn't even making that logical fallacy. I'm saying the external validity is changed when the operators are in an entirely different circumstance than a controlled lab setting, which is what most of these studies are.
All right.
In essence.
Number four, then.
Yeah. So how much clinical experience does it take to make up for no high-level evidence? And this question came about because I do have two trials to support my viewpoint and a major organization supporting my viewpoint. But let's pretend we didn't. And now you have John Sackles, airway expert, you know, one of the most prominent airway researchers in the United States. You have Cliff Reed, director of training for one of the most prolific helicopter EMS services. You have myself for whatever ridiculous stuff that brings to the table. All saying, you know, this has no face validity, that 1/3 of the cases are missed by endotracheal end-tidal CO2. where does that fit in? And I don't have a clear answer for this, but I'm sure there is some stuff that could be spoken about. When does clinical experience about things that are directly observable? Because your bloodletting experiment's the perfect example of where evidence is needed, because you don't see immediate results that could be directly attributable in a way where observation on your own part would actually have some validity. For instance, you give D50 to a hypoglycemic patient. Now, there might be downstream consequences. There might be complications. We might be taking out neurons. You need studies to show that. But if the patient does wake up, well, the first time it happens, you may say, oh, well, maybe it's just the irritation from pushing that IV. But if you do that a couple hundred times where the D50 was absent and they die or get permanent brain damage and you give it and they immediately talk to you, you begin to have some statements you can make based on your clinical observations. What do you think about that? You're so much better at these issues than I am, Ken.
I don't know if I'm better at these issues or not, but I think it's on a spectrum, and there's everything from the parachute trial to not jumping out of a perfectly good airplane with a backpack as a sham, or looking both ways before you cross the street. I don't need an RCT. I can rely on observational data for some of those decisions I make in life. And then there's the other end of the spectrum, and I don't want to bring up vitamin C right now. But the honest answer is, I don't know. I don't know how much clinical experience it takes to make up for the lack of high-quality evidence, and I'm not sure if anyone knows. I think it's important to recognize and for the listeners to hear that most of what we do lacks high-quality evidence. And I've made a claim there, so I'll just look at the recent AHA guidelines, and less than 10% of their recommendations that they make in the latest AHA guidelines come from level A evidence. And in fact, 50% are level C evidence. So there's very few things in medicine that are thou shalt do this and thou shalt not do that. And I think both you and I, and hopefully everyone listening, are all just trying to provide patients with the best care based on the best evidence that we have in front of us. And we want to have an NNT of one. We want to help every single patient that walks through or is wheeled through the doors. And you have a comment about that, about your, what drives you and what your NNT of one is.
Yeah, my whole thing is just relieve suffering. And that's something you don't need fantastic clinical evidence to support as an absolute conviction.
Absolutely. And you know, so when it comes to clinical experience, is it number of years? Is it number of cases? Is it how many times you've done it in the sim lab? Is it how many times you've taught the concept? Again, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't either. But I guess the last question I'd have for you, and I guess we could look at it from a couple different lenses, but I guess I'll start with the easiest one is, can non-clinical experts interpret clinical literature?
And I asked you for a little bit of an elaboration on what you meant by non-clinical experts. Who are these non-clinical experts?
Yeah. So, and you talked about, well, of course, the statistician could interpret the stats and have no clinical knowledge whatsoever. And that's absolutely true. What I'm saying is, if you are a medical student who's maybe seen a couple of cases and has never been the primary physician for any of them, could that person really understand and interpret literature? And it's my contention that they probably can't. That so much of evidence-based medicine is taking as one of a three-legged stool the actual evidentiary support. And then you need the individual patient in front of you, and then you need your clinical expertise. And all three of those have to go into any decision you're going to make. And this was absolutely intrinsic to the original publications on evidence-based medicine, the JAMA book. All of this interprets evidence in the face of both the individual patient and your clinical knowledge. And it's, I think, dangerous to think that the study itself is an adequate way to determine what is right and wrong for your patients.
Absolutely. And I never, at least I hope I never, and there I've said a never comment.
You haven't.
But I really endeavor not to make those kind of claims that we should just rely on the literature. I'm always the one pounding the desk as the EBM advocate saying the literature is just one of three components that Dave Sackett originally proposed back in the early 90s about what evidence-based medicine was. And so that's why I continue to say that the literature doesn't dictate our care and should not dictate our care. It informs us and it guides us. So with that theoretical medical student, there can be a theoretical medical student, and I actually don't even have to have them theoretical. I know of medical students who have PhDs in methodology and biostatistics. They could come in and teach me quite a bit, and I would be okay with that because they have much more experience and expertise on talking about study design and how to recruit people and how to randomize and what's the best test to actually probe that literature for its validity. But then again, I have more clinical experience than them. And then we always have to turn and face our patients and ask them, what do they value? What are their preferences? So can non-clinical experts interpret the clinical literature? Yes, they can, but it'll all depend on who that individual and who that non-clinical expert is and how good their interpretation will be.
Absolutely correct. And that one, that's the softball. The harder question, the more contentious question, my last question for you is, can non-content experts truly interpret the clinical literature?
So define non-content.
Okay, so we're all, I think most of the listeners of your show, emergency physicians or emergency nurses or paramedics. And so we have a subject expertise in a trial on, for instance, apneic oxygenation. And you could read a very well-wrought, internally valid, from I think most people's perspective, study on apneic oxygenation and say, oh, I could actually trust the conclusions of the trial. I looked at it, it looks good, it's well done. And then it takes someone to actually know the intricacies of apneic oxygenation to realize that there was no jaw thrust done in this study. And it was never mentioned in the methodology. And you actually had to write to the study authors to find out whether or not there was any maintenance of a patent airway. And only someone who is a content expert in that, who is doing their own work on this area, may know something very tiny that was never even mentioned in the study that radically changes the results. I mean, I'm sticking with the apneic ox stuff because it's one area I feel that I've put a lot of time in to gain a content expertise. Another trial, they were bagging the patients during the apneic period in their control group. I don't even know if it was mentioned in the trial. If it was, it was in a supplement somewhere. It mentioned in the most offhand manner. That entirely changes the interpretation of that trial. And yet there's things like that going on all the time that you could read, not just the abstract. You could read the whole study and pour over it. And unless you know these tiny little idiosyncratic facts about that area, your ability to interpret the study is markedly flawed. And I just wanted to know your thoughts on that, Ken.
I agree with what you've been saying about how clinical experts, especially in their content area, bring so much to the table. And it's one of the reasons we do the SGEM Hot Off the Press episodes, where we actually get to interview the lead author, because there's often things that were cut due to editorial decisions and stuff that weren't in there. Or you have to go searching through supplemental appendixes and get behind paywalls, or things that are in the bottom of their drawer that they didn't decide to include for certain reasons. So absolutely having content experts really enriches the interpretation of the clinical literature. And I always look to go that extra mile when I'm trying to reach out to those content experts, because I'm certainly not a content expert on everything. I'm just a community doc.
Yeah, none of us are content experts on everything, rather. Yeah, absolutely.
But I would say, though, that when you have content experts, there's a risk at the other end of the spectrum. And I think that this has to be recognized with regards to cognitive biases. And there is literature on this. Once you get so invested in something with regards to things like anchoring bias, recall bias, hindsight bias, intellectual bias, clinicians, I'm one of them. I can have biases. There are certain things I like, and so you read the literature a certain way. There's certain things I'm not so sure about, and I recognize, and I try more and more to recognize these biases and minimize them. But, you know, they've looked at the evidence when you have content experts, so somebody who has written a primary study in a certain area, and then they've done a systematic review of that, and they've asked methodologists who have certain areas of expertise beyond the clinical expertise, and they've asked the clinicians to interpret the literature. And there is a dissonance. And that dissonance doesn't, I wouldn't want to say it's right or wrong, like positive or negative. It's just different. And so I think we should all try to come together to interpret the literature and add what we can to the literature. So the content experts, absolutely. If you know that, hey, they didn't even do that jaw thrust maneuver in this, this is going to cause spurious outcomes. But you also need those other individuals that say, hey, listen, you know, you did a bland Altman analysis and you probably should have done this. You know, and I'd be going, you know what? I didn't know that, but thank you for bringing that to the table and helping me better interpret the clinical literature. So I think if we come together as a community, we will do a much better job at interpreting the clinical literature and getting away from, you know, declarative statements as this is wrong 100% or this is right 100%. It's much more nuanced than that.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, those were the five questions you had for me, Scott.
That's it.
That's it? Okay, well, I want to turn the question around on you. Is there anything else you'd like to emphasize, if we haven't done it enough, or something new that you'd like to bring to the table that you want the SGEMers to hear about the issue of end-tidal CO2? Because it's sort of like putting a pin on it at the end, because this was something that was really important to you, that you made sure that people knew that end-tidal CO2 for endotracheal tube placement was key, was paramount.
Yeah, what I'll say is this. You had made the statement that some places are rural, they may not have this, and therefore ultrasound may offer another thing to perform this confirmation. And I got to say, and this is a soapbox issue, and I have no support on this in the evidence, Ken, but I'm going to say it anyway. And I don't want to talk about underserved, under-resourced countries because I have no knowledge to be able to talk about their healthcare systems. But in the United States and Canada, rural or urban, I think it is, at this stage, not acceptable to not have waveform end-tidal CO2. This is not an expensive technology. It's pretty much dirt cheap. If you really wanted to, you could buy it once and never have to pay for a device again. Every single person should have access to waveform end-tidal CO2. I think in 2019, it's really not good practice to not be confirming your endotracheal tubes with waveform capnography.
So if you're listening, take a moment. Go to your department and find out, do you have end-tidal CO2 abilities at your place where you provide care? And if you don't, bring that up through the proper methods in your institution and advocate to make sure that you have this important device to help you manage patients who are arresting. All right, well, there's only one last thing to do. And I need you to say the SGEM tagline, and you've got to do it with, you know, that really good Scott Weingart voice, the voice made for podcasting, with a little bit of a New York accent in there, if you could.
Yeah, well, I've been waiting for this. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.
Oh, that was so much fun.